Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as exploring the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital, and I'm here today with Sheba Phillip, CEO of Akoa, a woman's lifestyle brand that offers exceptional design, on-trend custom jewelry products made by women in extreme poverty. Welcome, Sheba. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
I'm excited to be here.
I'm going to ask a series of questions. So no pressure here. There's no right or wrong answer. Why don't we start off and give us a little background of yourself, maybe where you grew up, where you went to school, and just a high level of your career.
I always kind of define, I think, the last 20 years of my career as a career building brands with purpose. And I think it started from my childhood. I was born and raised in New Jersey. I'm an East Coast girl. My parents are from India. They immigrated here many years ago. My dad went to college here and he married my mom. And I was born here in the U.S. shortly after they were married. And we've always kind of created this kind of environment, our home, that we need to be using our gifts and our talents for purpose and for doing good things and great things in the world. I was born and raised in a Christian home. And so I was always kind of surrounded by this idea of how are you sharing your faith through your work and through what you do. And so that's from a very young age, that was part of my growing up and part of my narrative. I went to college as a chemical engineer. That was my major, which, you know, I always laugh and tell people, like, if you're South Asian, if you're an Indian person, like, your two options are basically become a doctor or a lawyer, an engineer, and maybe the third is a lawyer. But at the time, it was about science and math. And I went to University of Virginia, graduated with a degree in engineering, and quickly started my career actually in the pharmaceutical industry, working for Merck Pharmaceutical. I was working in the area of project management, building large capital facilities, pilot plant facilities to launch new drugs. And it's kind of funny now because I work in a space which is fashion and jewelry, but at the time I was wearing a hard hat and steel toe boots and managing construction workers. And that was when I got the first kind of taste of what leadership is like. How do you rally people, get them around a vision, build something great together, and lead people often very different than you, which was, in the case of me, a college grad leading construction workers, but it was a tremendous leadership experience. I also realized that I was really fascinated by the why. You know, why does a business do what they're doing? Why was Merck launching this drug? Why now? Why this therapeutic area? And I realized that while I loved engineering, I had a kind of a penchant for business. I wanted to really get at the why and be at the table where critical decisions are being made that shape the future of an organization. With that in mind, I took the leap to go to business school. I went to Harvard Business School, graduated in 2003. And that's kind of where the whole career branding with purpose started. I came out of Merck, went to business school, and then jumped into the food and beverage industry. I spent 10 years working for Kraft Foods, leading big brands for them like Ritz Crackers and Jell-O, and was the marketing director for Oreo, which is a global business in over 100 countries around the world. And I always tell people, like, you know, food is a purpose-driven category. It's all around connecting people together through obviously great tasting food, but through the emotional experience of having a meal together with people. And to me, I really learned that art of driving brands with purpose and telling that story of brands with purpose through my work at Kraft. As I was working on Oreo, I spent a lot of time in the developing world, and particularly actually in India. So you would think I had gone to India a lot before my career, but actually no. I mean, I was raised in the U.S. I went to India maybe once when I was a child or twice. And suddenly I found myself going to India a lot more for work. We were launching Oreo in India. I was spending time in Mumbai. And, you know, when you're there, for those of you who have not been to India, I mean, it's such an incredible country, but the poverty is so real and so tangible. It's in your face all the time. And I started to think about, like, how can my skills and my gifts be used to really change people's lives? So long story short, I decided to start thinking, you know, at the time I was about 10 years into my time at Kraft, really wanted to step into a new phase in my career, started interviewing in different industries. And as God would have it, at the time of my job search, I was brought to the attention of International Justice Mission. They're a very large NGO based in DC, and they were looking to bring in somebody to be the head of marketing to take kind of classical CPG branding and bring it to the area of modern day slavery and try to figure out a way to tell that story in a way that connects people. And so, as I've mentioned, Jeff, like my God was really stirring in my heart for many, many years, this idea of brand and purpose. And now suddenly I get to take this classical training and this MBA background to the nonprofit space. And so I did a radical thing. I left my career craft, and I'm just so appreciative of the company and what they did for me skills wise. And I took those gifts and skills to IJM. I spent 2 years leading the organization in brand marketing and crisis communications, had a tremendous experience there, learned so much about the art of storytelling and the art of, again, telling the purpose of brands. And, you know, realized at the time, though, that while I loved the nonprofit experience, I really had a heart for business and I wanted to get back into business. So in 2015, I moved to Dallas and joined the turnaround team for JCPenney, and was invited in to be lead marketing and communications and media buying and planning for them. And for me, this was like the most challenging brand with purpose, because this was a brand that was over 100 years old, was founded by someone who wanted to bring purpose to retail, democratize retail for the masses. And it was a struggling brand, and it needed a reinvention. So I joined the company and helped launch a new campaign, a new aesthetic for the brand. And, it was a very tough turnaround. Obviously, everyone knows the story of JCPenney today. And I realized this wasn't for me. While I had an opportunity to shape the brand, I really wanted to touch all facets of the business. And I wasn't able to do that in just pure marketing. So I stepped down from my role. I took some time off. Then about 18 months just traveling, connecting, reconnecting to this desire of leading brands of purpose and trying to figure out what that would look like for me. So up to that point, I had done private sector, I had done public sector, I had done food, I had done retail, I had done global, I had worked in the US, and I was like, okay, what does all of this mean? I got involved during this time with Praxis, which is, as many people know, right? And I started serving as an advisor for their entrepreneurs. And that's when I was really exposed to what does it look like to be an entrepreneur, to really build a brand from the ground up. Up to that point, all of the businesses I ran were very big. The largest business, smallest business, I'm sorry, that I ran was 50 million. So this was not like, this was like such a different world for me. And I was not a traditional CEO for a startup. But I started to realize, like, I want to get that. I want to build something from scratch. I want to put my imprint on something. And I was so inspired by what I was seeing in Praxis, these brands that were just doing this redemptive work in business and in nonprofit. I met Brittany Underwood, who was the founder of Acola. It was a nonprofit that had gone through the Praxis Accelerator. And at the time I met her, she was actively thinking through the restructuring of the company to a for-profit. So I joined the company last year as their CEO, and I've been on the journey with Acola ever since. And it's really interesting, like when I look back at my 20-year career, it's a lot of twists and turns, but I think every single experience has uniquely prepared me for this role as CEO for Acola. I just can't imagine if any one of those experiences didn't happen, I would not have the skill set I think I have now to take this company forward.
It's these conversations why I love interviewing and having these podcasts, because clearly you have had a number of really unique experiences, obviously, which led you to where you are today. And I'll just vouch, as a former executive of a fairly large company and now an entrepreneur, it is clearly a different skill set being an entrepreneur versus an executive.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you may have already answered this, but I'm gonna ask it anyways, because you may be able to pontificate a little bit more. How would you best describe yourself in light of where you are at in your journey?
I would say I'm a leader in transformation. I'm a leader that's transforming and in the path to transformation. And what do I mean by that? I think, you know, as someone who's inspired by their faith, I feel like I am leading in a way that's helping me transform into the likeness of who God is and his character. I always tell people that work is the most, probably the most sanctifying thing you're ever going to participate in. I mean, for many people, obviously it's marriage or family. For me, it's been work. It's been the place where my struggles have been exposed, my character flaws are exposed, the things that I am not the proudest of are exposed. It's where I, by the grace of God, I'm shaped more and more like him. So I would say I'm a leader and a person in transformation. Absolutely. I think Akola has been the most exciting, but the most challenging career assignment I've ever had, ever. And that could be probably another podcast on its own. It's what I've learned as in the area of endurance and grit and determination and pushing something up a hill. I mean, this is like not for the weary. And I feel that that's for every entrepreneur who listens to this podcast. I'm sure they're nodding their heads furiously at this, because that is absolutely what it feels like. And so I think that idea of transformation of character at me being this better leader is happening. When I say leader in transformation, I also mean transforming the people around me. I really believe leaders are meant to raise up the people around them. And sometimes it doesn't feel good because nobody wants to be pressured and pushed to greatness sometimes. But I feel as leaders, like you have to do that. You have to be in a situation where if I left today, I have a team that could take the ball and move forward. And so in all of my roles and all my career, I've always been like, how can I get this team to be great? Great in how they see themselves, how they see each other, how they're living out their God-given potential. And so to me, I'm in a season of transforming the people around me, hopefully, and getting them to rise and to kind of live out who I think God's meant them to be and created them to be. And then I would say I'm a leader in transforming businesses. I mean, this is the fun stuff. I truly love taking a business problem or taking a business and reinventing it or igniting it or transforming it. In my career, I typically have found myself either establishing a business or turning around a business. And to me, that's where my blood just like pumps. And so I think for Akola, it's a interesting journey. It's a 12-year startup. I mean, think about the paradox of that. It's 12 years as an NGO that's now becoming a commercial brand, a social venture, a retail startup. And that restructuring is what I've been living through the last year and a half. And that transform, how do you transform a company DNA to kind of behave differently and operate differently is what I'm about right now with Akola. So I would say I'm an absolute season of transformation in my character, in the way I look to transform the people around me, and the way I'm transforming Akola.
So this next question then, I think you can answer however you want, but I think because I'm going to ask it in relation to Akola, because I think I would love for those listening to understand what you guys do specifically, because I love the mission of it. So in that context, how are you or how is Akola trying to change the world?
Akola is trying to change the world by creating sustainable jobs and dignified employment for the poorest of women, for women in need. It's about job creation for women. Akola, the name means she works, and it means she works in a local Ugandan dialect. As I mentioned before, it was founded by Brittany Underwood, who was an entrepreneur, and she got the practice accelerator for nonprofits. She'd gone to Uganda and saw just the beauty of Ugandan women and how much they're working so hard to care for their families. But at the end of the day, there was not a path for them to have sustainable income and economic empowerment. Many of the women she was working with were from rural villages. You know, even as much as Africa has developed now, there's still an underdevelopment in the manufacturing sector and industries where women that are not educated or have little skill sets can still come in and build a sustainable long-term career. She started having these women just use their craftsmanship and their natural skills to make jewelry. And she made it under a tree with them, some beaded jewelry. She goes to Dallas and starts selling this jewelry to people. And before she knows it, 3 years ago, Neiman Marcus comes to her and says, we want to carry your product in our stores. And for those of you who are not in retail, like, this is game changing, because you don't see in a Neiman Marcus a brand that can sit against national luxury brands, have the quality, have the craftsmanship, have the design of a cola, but built by the hands of the poor. And, you know, usually what you see in social enterprise businesses, it's lower quality, lower priced. It's an artisan model where you kind of, hey, hire a woman, she makes a basket and you sell it, which is fine. But what we were doing was very different. We were creating vertically integrated manufacturing. We were directly employing these women. And we were not just employing them, or Brittany was not just employing them, but she was wrapping social services around them. So you would have a job, but you're also getting trained on how to open a bank account, how to start a chicken farm, or you can create a secondary income, how to build emotional resilience and confidence, which, you know, you don't think you need to be taught on that. But if you're a woman who has had no education, no ability, no one affirming who you are, you know, just having a job is not enough. You need to have the confidence to go into that job and be excellent at your work and take the money earned and create empowerment for yourself. And that's a life skill that many women are not trained or taught to have in Uganda. And so this was not just a job, it was a path to transforming a life. And what we found was that when women have jobs, what happens? Well, they're educating their children at a faster rate. They're owning homes and land. They're holding positions in our community. So fundamentally, a cola is about creating a pathway of transformation for women in extreme poverty through job creation. And we, of course, do it through a beautiful luxury jewelry brand, because we want to connect women with tremendous purchasing power and men with tremendous purchasing power to women who lack a voice. But fundamentally, why we get up every single day is to create a job that then not only transforms that woman's life, but her children's lives, her family, and the community around her.
Okay, so you're going to make a bunch of us feel like our jobs are insignificant, because that's absolutely changing the world. So I love what you guys are, love what you're doing. You know, it's interesting, because I've been in the impact investing space for about 5 years now. And typically, when you think about impact investing, it's something overseas.
Right.
Honestly, it could be Wells or whatever. But it's interesting with the situation 2020 and jobs. I think people are recognizing, even here in the United States, the power, in a more meaningful way, the power of a job,
absolutely,
of an income, of the dignity of work.
Yes.
I've done a lot of prison work and going to a prison system. And what you realize in this, a lot of times the cases, I've been more into the men's side of things, they long to have a job. There's meaning in that job. It's not just the paycheck, which clearly is important. And so, yeah, it is. I think here in the United States, we've taken that for granted. And I think one of the positives of what was happening in 2020 is just this affirmation that we're created to work, which is, I think, you basically articulated. All right, so let me switch gears here. And this is more personal, although you can answer however you want. When did you personally realize the power of capital?
I will say I realized the power of capital when I joined the company and we hadn't closed our seed round. So, I mean, you know, it's interesting. You know, Jeff, I grew up, like I said, in my career, Kraft, JCPenney, well-funded companies. You're not thinking capital. You're just thinking, how do I prepare for the quarterly earnings report? How do I host our shareholders? You're managing multi-million dollar budgets. And, you know, it's a different game and a different world. And suddenly now I'm in a situation, I joined the company in March of last year. We had just restructured the company into a for-profit, we are started the process. I was leading that restructuring. And here I was trying to figure out, how do we raise capital off of this new narrative of an NGO that's now becoming a for-profit, this social venture that's now a viable, high-potential retail brand. And what I realized was that the power of capital was absolutely needed to extend this mission. People ask me all the time, why did you guys convert to for profit and secure a private investment? You know, are you walking away from your mission? I'm like, absolutely not. The only reason we could actually employ women and keep this mission of job creation not just alive, but thriving, is if we have a working capital system that's funneling high productive investment into this company. And you know, you can only go so far on a donor-based model. And so what I've seen working capital do is multiple fronts. One, it has secured best-in-class talent that I never could get as an NGO. So I hired the former creative director of a top jewelry brand coming out of New York City. I hired a woman who's Ugandan, leading our manufacturing operations, who has 20 years from Unilever. Vestor Board could hire me, which was coming out of 20 years, you know, in private sector. I mean, the game completely opens up when you've got capital and you can charge to attract talent, the right talent for this mission. The second thing I would say is that what the capital has done, you know, obviously given us a level of excellence and rigor into our business. When you've got investors now looking into your business, I mean, game on. You need to operate like a professional commercial business. And so I've spent a lot of time with my team putting in the best in class principles of running a business that I learned coming out of Kraft into this company, which is exciting. And I also think the power of capital really is like, going back to my transformative kind of, season I'm in, it transforms yourself as an investor. I've seen investors that are impact investors investing in Akola that are absolutely investors. They're looking to have a return on their investment, but they're also so transformed by being part of a greater work that's way bigger because of the capital. And that's changing women's lives and children's lives. So to me, the power of capital is just, it's multidimensional. It's getting the right talent, getting the right structure, and the operational principles are needed. And it's transforming the lives of the investors that are actually investing with us. And all of this is for the mission. Because I guarantee you that if we did not convert to a for-profit, if we did not get working capital to scale this company, we would not be in a position to weather this storm of COVID and feel very confident, even despite this pandemic, to have a future that's really established and set and moving in a great direction, all for these women that we employ in Uganda.
So what's interesting is, as you talk about this whole idea of going from a nonprofit to a for-profit, and so one of the things that drew me into impact investing was, look, you need nonprofits.
Right.
But nonprofits, you got to run out of money. There's just not enough money out there. Likewise, on the other side of the equation is governments. I mean, governments also run out of money. So there's this middle section, which is called business investing, that has a huge opportunity to make a difference. And then the other thing I would say is, as an investor, what brought me into impact investing was, yes, I get a thrill out of watching, for example, Akola and the women that are being impacted. Absolutely. But the other side of the coin, and you mentioned it, that often doesn't get talked about is when you invest that way, it really is, it changes the heart and psyche of the investor. And you articulated that, which is interesting because that's what drew me to it. Although generally people talk about the outward of where the capital is going. But if there's a joy and a freedom to start thinking about your capital in the context of not only does for you, but then for others. And so actually that leads into the next question is, and maybe this is as a CEO, you can answer this. Maybe this is as a personal investor, however you want to do this. What does the stewardship mean to you?
I'll start first with just as a person, as a leader. I think one is the first thing, the obvious is stewardship of talent. I think, you know, we've all been given talent, and too much is given, much is expected. And I actually don't believe that, you know, I've worked in private sector. I've worked in public sector. I've worked in ministry. And now I'm working in a social enterprise, which seems to be like the best of both worlds. But I really believe there's a heart for people to do great work and change the world and use their skills in all industries. This is not, I'm never going to promote this idea that you have to work a nonprofit or you have to be a social enterprise person. I think it's really around this beautiful marriage of your interests, what the world needs, and your skills. And when you, I mean, I'm a woman of faith. I spent a lot of time asking God what that is. And it's taken me 20 years to get, I think, to a place where I finally feel like I'm flowing in those three pieces. When that intersection of what the world opportunity is, what my gifts are, and what my passions are. And I think it takes time to form that. And stewardship is that road of getting to that intersection and being one, open to processing it that way, letting your gifts be open for God to use. I mean, I think that's a posture that we all have to have. So to me, stewardship of it's in talent. The other area is stewardship of time. And I think that as I get older, man, I'm having to learn how to say no more than I'm having to say yes. And for those of us that are, I'm guessing most of your audience are overachieving high performers.
That's a pretty safe guess.
Yeah, that don't know, and that we've awarded all of our lives in saying yes, yes to everybody, pleasing everybody, being perfect. And we would run ourselves to the ground, you know, because that was what we were supposed to do. Well, now in my 40s, I feel like I am learning a different way of running, which is being very strategic around my time. What is a good use of my time? Does this maximize not only impact around me, but my life? Is this value added or not? What am I going to give my energy to? And I think, you know, I'm not the best at it. My team will probably tell you that. I do spend a lot of time, probably not the most efficient things, but I'm learning to steward time better because, you know, in your 40s, you don't have, you're halfway done. And now it's about time. So I think talent is one, time is the other. And I would say if there's a third, as far as what I'm trying to steward, it's probably relationships. And, you know, I think in the spirit of this pandemic, I think it's forced us all to go to the heart of who are our people? Who do you want to spend time with? And it's kind of along the lines of stewarding your time, but to me, it's around, I want to do a better job of stewarding relationships, going deeper with people, deeper with the folks that I care about and love, both in my work environment and non-work environment. But I think it's so, so important that we go back to the heart of who we are as people that are meant to be in community, meant to be in partnership with other people. And that's something I want to do a better job of as well.
Again, I am on this side of the microphone, so I get to hear everybody's response. And I appreciate your comments there. Okay, we're going to end on this question. This one's kind of fun. There's no pressure. There's not a right answer. You don't have to have the best. You're number one. But if you could make one dream come true for your life, what would that be?
Man, I would love to be, well, that's a tough question, Jeff. I know. Think on this, and I still haven't, I think there's so many dreams I have, but really what I would love is to have a legacy of raising up young women to be great leaders in the world. I truly believe this. And that's why I joined Akola, was to lead and empower women in need, but also to just help raise the next generation of leaders that are women that are using their gifts, using their talents, using their voice to change the world. And my dream would be to see incredible entrepreneurs that are doing great things in the world, and for them to mention that the story of Akola or even understanding my journey as a leader has impacted them in some way. So I hope that Akola can become a case study of what great leadership looks like, you know, not just obviously me, but my team, and that it's a model for future Britneys of the world, future Shebas of the world, hopefully, that are going to take up the task of running companies that are doing great things.
Well, we appreciate you taking time to share your insights and your knowledge. I think it's been inspirational. I'm looking forward to hearing feedback. We'll be cheering for you. I'll put a shameless plug in for you. Make sure you go out to their website and check out the jewelry that they make. It's beautiful. In fact, we had a conversation before this started, and I think it's going to be a Christmas gift for my wife and my daughter. So thanks so much for joining us, and very much appreciate your wisdom.
Thank you.
Don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on the path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. I'm Jeff Schaefer. We'll see you next time. This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.